things that I've been working on a lot over the last few years. I think because most of us in this room are actually already friends, and many of you know about a lot of the results that I'm going to talk about. Rather than stick strictly to the formal format of my talk topic, as I go through some of these things, one, you should encourage me to skip through things that you already know, because some of you know a lot about some of these topics, and other things you should feel free to engage in more dialogue in points that you want to discuss more. Okay, so don't hesitate to interrupt me, and that way we can all get more out of this talk. Also because this is gonna be work that I've done with a variety of lovely people, and I presume many of them have come through giving talks on related topics, so some things you've already heard once before. All right, but this is based in part with work that started out with Kyle and actually also with Masha, until Masha had better taste than us, but has then progressed into great work with Simon Knoppen and Pietro Longhi, Andre Katz, Mats Drassler, Raman Sundrum, and then the last paper with Andre. And there's a number of other things that I'm still working on in this direction that I may or may not have time to mention. Okay. So motivational slide, because we're all pheno experts here, I can largely skip through this, but I think the real message that we have, of course, is we've discovered the reason that we have a hierarchy problem. You know, we have a standard model like Higgs, and so if we thought the hierarchy problem was an issue before, it's even more of an issue now. And what did we do in the past? Well, before we discovered the Higgs, we could imagine that electroweak symmetry breaking was rendered natural in a variety of ways, which didn't necessarily need to give us an elementary seeming scalar. But now that we have an elementary seeming scalar and a mass gap, we have to use symmetries to solve the hierarchy problem, modulo things like the relaxion. And the idea with all of these symmetries is, you know, the hierarchy problem is the statement that there's no symmetry that is manifest when the Higgs mass goes to zero in the standard model. And so all of these games, the idea is to extend the standard model in such a way that includes a new symmetry that is made manifest when the Higgs mass goes to zero, right? So we are expanding the standard model in such a way as to use the arguments of technical naturalness on the Higgs that we already use on things like fermions and gauge bosons. And that means there's a simple game, right? Coleman-Mandula tells us there are just a few symmetries we can possibly use in four dimensions that are consistent with non-zero, non-trivial S matrix. And the ones that we've put to use so far are supersymmetry and global symmetry. And the game works in the same way, right? Both of these render the Higgs mass technically natural in some sense. Both of them have to be broken at some scale. That leads us to some mass scale where there's new partner particles. And then those partner particles give threshold corrections that help to determine the Higgs mass. So we can't let the partner particles be too well separated from the Higgs mass, otherwise there would be cancellations between these finite threshold corrections. Just a couple of comments on this picture. You know, the first is that although these are different symmetries, the stories are very similar. The second comment is there's one more symmetry, of course, that's allowed by a Coleman-Mandula, which is conformal symmetry. How conformal symmetry could work to solve the hierarchy problem is much more subtle, but very interesting. And if you guys get really bored, we can change the talk to that and talk about that instead. But I won't be touching on conformal symmetry in this talk. But in either of these cases, the common note is the continuous symmetries commute with the standard model, and so that means there are partner states of standard model quantum numbers. Okay, and that's the inevitable conclusion if the symmetries commute with the standard model gauge group. And in particular, you know, for supersymmetry, you might want to be clever and say, nobody told me that all of my symmetries had to commute with supersymmetry, but of course we know for n equals 1, there is always a unique linear combination of global symmetries that do not commute, and that is the R symmetry, and so you can't get away with somehow having standard model gauge symmetries not commute with supersymmetry in a simple way. Okay. All right, but this plays out in a very simple way for the LHC. This means in either of these cases, whether it's supersymmetry or global symmetry, we have a spectrum of partner particles that give threshold corrections to the Higgs mass, and basically we can order where we expect to find them based on the size of threshold correction that each particle gives. So in the case of SUSY, of course, we have what we know as the natural SUSY spectrum. We expect light fermionic partners of the Higgs. We expect light scalar particles that are partners of the top quark and the bottom. And then we can space out the rest of the spectrum, may or may not be accessible to LHC. The same game is true in the case of global symmetries. Now global symmetries relate, for example, top quarks to other fermionic partner particles. And those also should be light in order to have the Higgs mass be relatively natural. But this means that we can ignore, you know, everything about complicated things that maybe have small cross-sections or that actually have interesting interactions with the Higgs. At the LHC, the game is our rules tell us we have new colored states that are beneath the TEV, and so we just look for them. And so we have this thing that I think Savas first called the missing top partner problem, maybe? I feel like this is a Savas thing. Missing top partner problem. I don't know if he called them top partners in the general sense. The idea, you know, so we know that these are the things that we have to look for. This is what naturalness drives us to consider. And so far, we have a very robust experimental search program at the LHC that has had nothing but null results. This is sort of the summary plot for CMS for looking for fermionic top partners of charge 2/3. So here the searches are a function of branching ratios to the different possible standard model final states. The limits change as a function of those final states, but they're all in the ballpark of about 700 GeV. This is the case. This is also the CMS summary plot for supersymmetry. This is looking for stops at the K into a top and the LSP. And in this case, the limits depend on where you are in this parameter space, but in the generic region of parameter space, the bounds are also out to about 750 GeV. Okay, so there's two problems. One is nothing yet, but it's possible that we still have the right theory of the universe and we just have to wait, and maybe once we get enough integrated luminosity at run two, we'll be in good shape. But problem two, is really a theorist's problem. It's a small violin problem, which is there's just not much to do, right? We've had 30 years to fully explore systematically how this works and how to look for these degrees of freedom and all of the possible loopholes in these search spaces and how to cover them. And so if you want to sort of make substantial new progress in thinking about new physics, there's just not a lot more to contribute to this picture. You just have to wait. Okay, so the question is this all there is? These are ideas that we've come up with because we had 30 years to think about them, but maybe until data pushes us out of our comfort zone, we haven't really been pushed in the most general way we can. And I think my position on this is you might find arguments for naturalness of the weak scale uncompelling, right? You might say, look, there's only one universe. I don't know how to talk about a fine-tuning measure. Nature is whatever we see. But the fact of the matter is thinking about the hierarchy problem has been the greatest signal generator that we've ever had in terms of thinking about looking for new physics. And so thinking more carefully about the hierarchy problem and other ways of possibly solving it pushes us to come up with new signatures, helps us to expand our search program at the LHC, helps us to allocate resources in places that we haven't been allocating them. So even if you don't like naturalness, you can just think of it as a clever trick that you can use to get experimentalists to do new searches. Okay. All right. So the natural thing that you might... That's right. Yeah, hopefully this is not okay. Can we erase that? Or we mute that part of the audio? All right. Okay. All right. So the natural thing that you might have guessed, this story, this sort of narrative that I had of us getting into problems with not seeing partner particles that are sort of forced upon us by solutions to the hierarchy problem. Well, the thing that probably occurred to you, the reason we predict those particles with interesting standard model quantum numbers is that we have a continuous symmetry that commutes with the standard model gauge group. And if we had a symmetry that somehow did not commute with the standard model gauge group, then perhaps we could avoid these conclusions. And the sort of natural candidate for such a symmetry would be a discrete symmetry as opposed to a continuous symmetry. All right. So a discrete symmetry you could imagine might work in the same way. In the ultraviolet, you have some exact discrete symmetry. There's some scale of spontaneous breaking of that discrete symmetry. It gives mass to some partner particles, and then those partner particles give finite thresholds to the Higgs that give us some relation between their mass scale and the mass of the Higgs. So it looks like a similar game to the story of continuous symmetries. It's just that now the partner particles don't necessarily have to carry the standard model quantum numbers of their standard model counterparts because it's a discrete symmetry that relates them, an exchange symmetry of some generalized sort rather than a continuous transformation. Now, there's lots of subtleties in this picture, right? You might have lots of questions about technical naturalness. There's a lot of subtlety actually about what we mean about technical naturalness when we talk about discrete symmetries. So I'll try to clarify when it becomes important what this buys for you relative to the continuous picture and what it doesn't and where you have to be careful. But this is the basic idea that you might try to explore. And the hope that this gives you new theories where partner particles are not charged under the standard model, we've started to call neutral naturalness. It's a terrible name. I don't want you ever to use it, but that's what the slogan is these days. All right, so we have a beautiful proof of principle.
This is
galaxies in his hair. Yeah. So we have a proof of principle actually of how this works that was come up with before the era of LHC-induced data desperation, which is called the twin Higgs. And it was written down by Chaco, Hoxhen Goh, and Ernie Harnack in 2005. And this really, this was nailing down the theses of neutral naturalness. The models demonstrate, contrary to conventional wisdom, stabilizing the weak scale does not require new light particles charged under the standard model gauge groups. And the symmetry they use to achieve this, in fact, is a discrete symmetry. It's an exchange symmetry between two copies of the standard model. And this really demonstrates in an essential way how discrete symmetries can serve to solve at least the little hierarchy problem. All right, so how does this work? I think most of you have seen the twin Higgs at this point, so I'm going to go through this very quickly. Who has not seen the twin Higgs? Kirsty? Nobody? Okay.
You're free.
You guys, you're free. It's okay. I'm not going to judge you if you haven't seen the twin Higgs. Okay. Okay. All right, well, I'll go through this very quickly. It's very interesting. You know, everyone likes to hear things they already know, so I will at least tell you things you already know very quickly. All right, so the idea is, just imagine we have a global symmetry, an SU4 global symmetry. Consider a scalar transforming as a fundamental. We can write down the marginal and relevant operators allowed by symmetries. Let's imagine the sign of the mass term for the scalar is consistent with spontaneous symmetry breaking. So of course, if I have such a potential, then at some scale, this scalar will get a vacuum expectation value that we just parameterize in terms of the potential. Let me call that order parameter F. That spontaneously breaks SU4 to SU3. And if we just count the Goldstones, there's 7 Goldstones. Okay. So now you imagine playing a game where you gauge an SU2 cross SU2 subgroup of the SU4. And so in some basis, you can imagine decomposing that original scalar as two doublets of the two different SU2s. I'll call them HA and HB. And in your mind, the back of your mind, you should keep in mind, think of SU2A as being related to us in some sense, and SU2B as being some twin sector. All right, so if this we've just gauged an SU2 cross SU2 subgroup of the SU4, a general spontaneous breaking of the SU4, of course, breaks both of the SU2s, unless you play some very clever vacuum alignment games. And so in general, that means 6 of those 7 Goldstones get eaten, and there's 1 left behind. And the 6 Goldstones then become the longitudinal modes of the SU2 gauge bosons. Okay, but of course, now you complain, by gauging them, I've explicitly broken the SU4. So in particular, I can compute radiative corrections to this picture. And if I just work in terms of the shorthand of some effective field theory with a uniform cutoff lambda, and I just compute loops up to that cutoff, of course, in a more complete theory, we would have finite calculations, and these would be finite threshold corrections. But just think about this as loop calculations up to some cutoff. Then in general, the fact that I have these gauge couplings that break the SU4, now there are quadratic threshold corrections to the Higgs masses, HA and HB, that depend on the cutoff squared. And so you can, by looking at this, it doesn't look like I've achieved anything, right? I had a global symmetry, it had some Goldstones, but I explicitly broke it by gauging, and I see that I get quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff. Yes?
Is this preserved at all loop
order? This, in fact, is preserved at all loop order. So this is a very special property. Yeah. So, the way that I'm telling you the story with SU4 as the global symmetry, technically I can actually write down higher dimensional operators that break the SU4 but preserve an O8 symmetry. And it's actually the O8 that, if you wanted to be really careful, is the one that you want to preserve. Okay. But modulo that subtlety, that's just a subtlety of exactly what you say the global symmetry is. You can think of this as being exact.
Have you talked about the
I won't, but I can. So you guys should feel free to divert me if you want to hear about something else. I'm happy to tell you about some other part of the story. It's just a one loop trick, and then you have a low cutoff. Yeah. In some sense, this is also, I'll get to it soon. This is slightly better. It's still a one loop trick in the sense that I'll make precise momentarily. Okay. But I think this is a sense that everyone understands, and Masha is probably really bored. So what is the trick? Well, the trick.
It's only a point.
The trick is that.
I have a very bad memory.
The trick is that if you imagine that the two sectors have the same gauge coupling, so if you relate SU2A and SU2B with the Z2 exchange symmetry, then these radiative corrections rearrange themselves. Then you get a quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff, but it's proportional to the same coupling for both HA and HB. And so you can pull those mass terms out. And now what you have is quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff that is multiplying something that actually is an SU4 invariant, right? Mod HA squared plus mod HB squared is just mod H squared. So that's an SU4 invariant. And so we know something about SU4 invariants in a potential. In particular, if we have a Goldstone of spontaneous SU4 breaking, the potential for the Goldstone accumulates nothing from SU4 symmetric terms in the potential. Okay. So what have we learned? We've learned if there's a Z2 symmetry that relates these two gauge couplings, although there is quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff, it organizes itself at the level of mass terms into an SU4 symmetric form. And that means this does not contribute to the mass of the Goldstone. Okay. So you have gauging that's explicitly broken at global symmetry, but at the level of mass terms, a Z2 is enough to restore the global symmetry. Okay, and that is the beautiful, that is the essential mechanism, right? This is, in all twin mechanisms, what is actually happening is that a discrete symmetry at the level of a mass term gives you a continuous symmetry for the mass terms. So anything that looks like a Goldstone of some continuous symmetry doesn't accumulate mass corrections of this form. All right, so that's all of the magic. That's how discrete symmetries can give you protection from quadratic sensitivity to a cutoff. Okay. All right, so how do you turn this into a theory that relates to the weak scale? Well, it's sort of fairly natural to generalize. You imagine instead of having SU2A, SU2B, you have standard model A, standard model B, with the Z2 that exchanges them. And so each one has a full copy of the standard model gauge group and a full copy of standard model matter fields and a full copy of all the standard model interactions, and all of the couplings are related by a Z2. Okay? And so now the story works as a natural generalization of what happened in the simple toy model. So just in the standard model, if I computed loops up to a cutoff, I would find some quadratic sensitivity to the cutoff, multiplying various standard model gauge couplings, Yukawa interactions. And now in this case, if I have a Z2 symmetry, I get the same quadratic dependence for both the A sector and the B sector. And because they all have the same couplings, then all of these corrections at one loop actually organize themselves into something that multiplies an SU4 invariant. So even though my only real symmetry is a Z2, if I have something that looks like a Goldstone of sort of SU4 symmetry breaking, that Goldstone won't pick up any of this quadratic sensitivity. Okay? So that's the natural generalization of how this twin mechanism can work for the standard model. And so now what you have to imagine is, all right, so there's a VEV in the A sector that breaks the A sector electric symmetry. There's a VEV in the B sector that breaks B sector electric symmetry. They sum to some order parameter that I'll call F. So if you could imagine, again, thinking of our SU2 and the twin SU2 as being embedded in a global SU4, then this is sort of the scale of breaking of that global SU4. And so when these guys get a VEV, that breaks the global SU4. It also Higgs's the electroweak group in sector A and sector B. And it gives us one uneaten Goldstone mode. So the idea is we want to associate that uneaten Goldstone mode with a standard model like Higgs. In this simple linear sigma model story, we'll also, of course, have a radial mode whose mass is around the scale F. And then we'll have a bunch of eaten Goldstones that just become the masses of our W and Z bosons and the twin W and Z bosons. So there's one further wrinkle, which is that if this were the whole theory and I had an exact Z2 symmetry, the potential that I could write down would give equal VEVs to the A doublet and the B doublet. Okay, that would tell us that the symmetry breaking in standard model A is the same size as symmetry breaking in standard model B. But if that's the case, the Goldstone mode that's uneaten is actually an even linear combination of these two sectors. So you would find that the Goldstone mode had couplings, sort of some couplings to the A sector and some couplings to the B sector. But if we want to identify that Goldstone with a standard model like Higgs, this is strongly at variance with standard model Higgs couplings, right? Standard model Higgs couplings tell us right now that the thing that we've seen is standard model-like to within at most about 25%, okay? So we need to change the story. We need to somehow align the Goldstone mostly with fluctuations around the standard model A sector. That will make it more standard model-like in its couplings. So to do that, we need to arrange for this vacuum expectation value to be less than this vacuum expectation value. In other words, we need V for electroweak symmetry breaking to be much less than the VEV in the B sector. The VEV in the B sector is taking up most of the order parameter for SU4 breaking. Okay, so we need to arrange V as much less than F. We can do so, but you pay a price of fine tuning. Basically, the fine tuning that you pay to arrange this is of order V squared over F squared. And so it is perfectly possible out of this to get a Goldstone Higgs that looks like a standard model like Higgs with corrections that are proportional to V over F. And there's a tuning. The smaller V over F is, there's a tuning that's directly proportional to that. Okay. So the picture that you should have in mind, if this is the theory of the weak scale, once you've accomplished making V much less than F, is we have the standard model A. That's our standard model that we know and love. It has a Goldstone-like Higgs in it. This is the Higgs that we see. And it has our normal top quarks and W and Z bosons. And then at the somewhat higher scale F, there's another sector, standard model B, which has a heavy Higgs mode and heavier particles whose masses are set by the scale F. And that's it. Okay. And the combination of these two sectors is enough to protect the Goldstone Higgs that lives in the standard model from one loop corrections, quadratic sensitivity to higher threshold corrections. Now, in this story that I've told you, a couple things should bother you. One is that I've told you this very nice linear sigma model story. And we found in this linear sigma model that there's a pseudo Goldstone who's protected from one loop corrections at the cutoff, right? But there's also a radial mode. And nothing about the mass of the radial mode was protected from that quadratic sensitivity. So we have to explain why the mass of the radial mode is at the scale F. Okay? So we need a further UV completion that basically is telling us what sets the scale F. And there are lots of ways we could think about that. So I'll briefly remind you of one way. So that's one shortcoming of this picture. We found a nice way to get a light Higgs without a continuous symmetry. But somehow we see the need for extra symmetries to protect scale F.
Sorry.
Yes?
I mean, the mass of the Goldstone does get corrections, which proportional to F, right? But just suppressed by some,
at the end of the day, they get something that's proportional to V. It's proportional. Well, they get okay. There's a variety of possible contributions to potential.
And then you get the extra tuning once you've made V much less than F.
Yeah. See, the point is that I think the corrections arise if you break the symmetry, right? If the symmetry is exact,
yeah. So
you still have the masses
So if the symmetry is exact, you get something that's proportional to an SU4 breaking but Z2 preserving quartic times F. Then if you arrange V to be much less than F, you in fact find it's... Yes, exactly. So ultimately, at the end, but what that actually told you was really what you got was the Z2 preserving SU4 breaking quartic times V. It's just that V was F over root 2 until you accomplish the tuning. Okay.
Yeah, so you got F before you tune.
Yes, yes. But the other thing that's just worth highlighting is even before you tune V with respect to F, there's the thing that I call the radial mode. It's Higgs, its quartic coupling is proportional to an SU4 symmetric quartic times F, and the Goldstone is proportional to an SU4 breaking quartic times F.
So F is sensitive to quadratic, to the higher scales,
yes.
And the Goldstones are first before you tune sensitive to the higher scales.
Yes, but then once you accomplish the V over F tuning, now you parametrically separate. All right, so that should point out to you, so there, you know, we've seen a little miracle, right? We get protection from threshold corrections at higher scales through just a discrete symmetry, but at the price that we actually need to explain now the naturalness of a somewhat higher scale. OK, just to highlight, what is the role of the twin top in this theory? So I told you we wanted to avoid theories where we solve the hierarchy problem by predicting new partner particles charged into the standard model. So you can ask, how exactly does the cancellation mechanism work? Well, you can think about how this looks in the low energy effective theory, where you integrate all of the heavy particles out in the twin sector. And so when you do that, you started with, you know, in our sector, a normal Yukawa coupling to the top quarks to the Higgs doublet in the A sector. And with the Z2 symmetry, you had the same thing in the B sector. Then, of course, now these guys get VEVs. We break the SU4 symmetry. We can integrate out the heavy radial mode. And in the low energy effective theory, what we get is a coupling of the pseudo-Goldstone Higgs to our top quarks. And then we get the sort of coupling of the pseudo-Goldstone Higgs to the other sector's top quarks that you could think of as being given by integrating out the radial mode or alternately by expanding on the Goldstone manifold. And this is precisely the form of the coupling that's required for this loop up to a constant cutoff to cancel this loop, right? So by integrating out the heavy mode, here I have the Higgs coupling with its normal sign to the top Yukawa. Here I get, I flip the sign, and I get the coupling with the special scale that is precisely what is required for this loop to cancel this loop. Okay, so in the low energy effective theory, this is precisely the cancellation mechanism that we expect from global symmetries, even though the only actual symmetry we had was a Z2. All right, so what is the slogan of the twin Higgs? How does this mechanism work? The slogan is, the Higgs is a pseudo-Goldstone boson, not of a continuous global symmetry, right? Just of an accidental global symmetry that we get just for quadratic terms in the action once we have this discrete symmetry. But there is an extra requirement that I've sort of alluded to, and I'll get to more precisely in just a second. You also need a symmetric quartic coupling. So in particular, I said we had a radial mode whose mass was of order the scale F, and then we have a Goldstone Higgs whose mass was of order V. But in reality, of course, as Riccardo Rattazzi would remind us, these are not scales, right? What would the alien say with a different value of H bar? Mass scales, of course, have couplings times vacuum excitation values. And so the radial mode gets a mass scale that's proportional to some SU4 symmetric quartic coupling, namely a quartic coupling of the form HA squared plus HB squared squared. Okay, that gives us a mass to the radial mode. Such a quartic does not give a mass to the Goldstone boson because it's an SU4 invariant. So this instead gets a mass that comes from quartic couplings that break the SU4 but preserve the Z2 that are of the form HA to the fourth, HB to the fourth. Okay. So what is the small lie that lives in the twin Higgs model? All right, we had the Z2 symmetry that gave us some sort of accidental global symmetry at the level of the mass terms. But in order to get any hierarchy of scales where there's a radial mode that is much heavier than a very light pseudo-Goldstone, we also needed some reason why there was a large SU4 symmetric quartic in the theory. But a large SU4 symmetric quartic is not given to you by saying the word Z2, right? So you needed some other reason why this ingredient was present. OK. So all right, big picture. Hopefully we all know the big picture. So why is this not the theory of the universe? OK. So four reasons why it's not the theory of the universe. One is this reason we've been discussing. It's not UV complete. So the scale F has a hierarchy problem that has to be solved. And you want to believe that you can solve that hierarchy problem without ruining this mechanism. Second reason it's not the theory of the universe is the symmetry is just not quite enough. So as I just discussed, we can get a pseudo-Goldstone Higgs just from the Z2. But to make it light with respect to other stuff, we needed a large SU4 symmetric quartic that was not given to you by saying the word Z2. Third problem is the cosmology sucks. Okay, so if we have our standard model and this twin standard model that are related by a Z2, that means the twin sector has a lot of light fermions that have nothing to do with the hierarchy problem, but live around to give a large contribution. You know, they have a thermal population of them, And these two sectors are in thermal equilibrium down to relatively low temperatures. So for example, there's a large contribution to ineffective from fermions in the twin sector that is currently at variance with bounds that we have from Planck. And then the final thing, which is more of a sort of a motivational question, is it's not clear if this is just a weird exception. There's one particular choice of a symmetry that gives us a solution to the hierarchy problem without light standard model charged partner particles. Or is it an example, is it somehow a simple example of a much more general set of ideas? Okay. So I want to try to systematically address all these questions, and then you can decide whether or not this is still, in fact, the theory of the universe. Okay, so here's a story that I'll tell very briefly because I think I've inflicted it on many of you before. So the question to UV completion is actually very nice. So the thing that you might naturally have wanted to do, being in North America, is use supersymmetry to solve the hierarchy problem for the scale F. And this actually turns out to work in a very beautiful way. So again, we have this story where we have the scale V, we have the scale F, we have to protect the scale F from UV sensitivity. And so instead of using supersymmetry to protect the weak scale, we can use supersymmetry to protect the scale F. That tells us in general we don't expect to see superpartners around the scale V. We could imagine seeing them around the scale F where they're not in tension with LHC limits. So the generalization to supersymmetrize this mechanism is straightforward. Instead of standard model A, standard model B with the Z2, you do MSSM A, MSSM B with the Z2. Now, of course, MSSM is a two Higgs doublet model, but you can go to a decoupling limit where you can decouple the extra Higgses in both sectors, and then the whole story goes through just as it did for the standard model. So there are just a couple really cute things about this. So the first thing is we had this question of, well, where do we get a large SU4 symmetric quartic coupling if our theory only has a Z2? But in supersymmetry, of course, we know that the only way we get quartic couplings is either by superpotential interactions or gauge interactions. And so the easiest way to give a quartic coupling to these multiplets is to have some sort of singlet with an NMSSM-like coupling to both sectors that when we put the singlet to its F term gives a scalar potential for H up and H down that gives us these quartic interactions. But the quartic that you get from such a singlet precisely has the form of an SU4 symmetric quartic coupling. That is to say, if I just take this and I compute the scalar potential for H up and H down in both sectors that follow from the superpotential, I get a quartic of this form. But to get this, all I had to do was say that the singlet coupling respected a Z2, right? Then the SU4 I got for free. So supersymmetry naturally explains why you have a large SU4 symmetric coupling without having to actually put the SU4 symmetry in by hand. So that's very nice. The second thing that's very nice is it gives you...
what did you say that lambda goes to infinity is the limit?
Oh, sorry. If you wanted to imagine... Good. So this is one way to get a quartic coupling. Of course, we also know that we get quartic couplings from gauge interactions in supersymmetric theories. And so, of course, there's also a quartic coupling coming from the SU2 cross U1 of both of these sectors.
Oh, yes.
Now, that respects only the Z2, and it breaks the SU4, right? So in addition, so I get an SU4 symmetric quartic coupling from a sort of NMSSM type interaction. But then I also get an SU4 breaking but Z2 preserving correction proportional to the gauge couplings. So the theory becomes exactly SU4 symmetric when the quartic is very large with respect to the gauge couplings.
I see.
Okay. When they're finite with respect to each other, now there are corrections, but those corrections turn out to be exactly the right size. In particular, right, so those quartic couplings, right, the ones proportional coming from D terms, they give us a mass for the pseudo-Goldstone Higgs because they break the SU4, but they respect the Z2, right? So the mass that they give for the pseudo-Goldstone Higgs at the level of the mass squared, remember in the MSSM our prediction is, this is what the hockey stick is for. In the MSSM our prediction for the Higgs mass is the mass squared at tree level is mz squared with a cosine squared 2 beta factor plus radiative corrections. And in this theory, it's twice that at the level of the mass squared. And you can think about that because when you integrate out the heavy radial mode, you actually carry over the quartic coupling from the twin sector over to the pseudo-Goldstone Higgs. So basically, it's sort of like a non-decoupling D term, except it's a non-decoupling D term through a pseudo-Goldstone Higgs. And so that gives you actually the D term both from the MSSM and from the twin MSSM sector. But this is great, right? Because at tree level, if the cosine squared term is large, or is 1, then your prediction for the Higgs mass is root 2 times mz, which is about 129 GeV, which is not far from what we see. And if tan beta is closer to 1, then you can get yourself exactly in the right ballpark. So that's beautiful because unlike normal supersymmetric theories, you have a wonderful prediction for the Higgs mass, and you don't have to be nervous about you know, naturalness and fine tuning by explaining the Higgs mass. And you can work out all the other details, you know, if you have a very powerful collaborator. And the answer is that you can make this UV completion work without spoiling any of the fine points of the twin mechanism. Okay, so
you need to get rid of the first family, though.
Yes. So you still this is just asking the question of the UV completion. It's not solving anything about the cosmology. All right. So that was the first question. I think this was my fourth question, which is, well, all right. So I could believe that this is possibly how part of the universe works. But the other thing, as a theorist, you'd like to understand is. Is this just some weird point in theory space? I mean, this model stood on its own for 10 years. Or you want to ask the question, is it an example of some general mechanism? And if it's an example of some general mechanism, maybe there's a whole landscape of phenomenology that we can start to explore. So this was a question that Simon and Pietro and I started to try to answer. And our approach to this was, well, you could just say the Z2 symmetry was a fundamental symmetry of the universe. But we know discrete symmetries come from sort of one or two places. Either they're just a fundamental symmetry that relates different sectors, or they're a residual symmetry. Maybe we had a larger continuous symmetry that was broken at some scale, and as a residual of that spontaneous breaking, or a residual of that breaking of that continuous symmetry, we get a discrete symmetry as a leftover ingredient. Okay? So in particular, something like a Z2 exchange symmetry often, you know, to me at least, it looks like actually it came from the reduction of symmetries by an orbifold. So as a reminder, you know, orbifolds, this is just the quotient space of a manifold modded out by a discrete group. It's just a manifold with boundaries. We use them lots in string theory. We love them in string theory. It's the only way to get realistic standard model vacua. So basically the idea is just imagine, you know, one way you could think about getting something like this from some UV physics is if there's some, for example, higher dimensional manifold with boundary conditions that when the theory is dimensionally reduced, it leaves behind extra discrete symmetries that relate the matter content to the low energy sector. Okay, if that's all you ever want to learn about overfolds, that's perfectly acceptable, although there's a lot of deep UV model building you can do to figure out where this comes from. So to try to make use of this, if that's the observation, that the symmetries of the twin Higgs look like they came from an orbifold, the question is now, can we systematically build other types of orbifolds where we also get discrete symmetries that give us twin-like models? And do these models also work to solve the hierarchy problem? So the approach that we took to try to address this question was actually instead of building a string theory or even an extra-dimensional field theory, you can actually study the essential physics of orbifolds purely at the level of four-dimensional field theory by constructing field theories and then doing an orbifold projection on them to identify different parts of the field theory with itself. And that gives you some daughter theory whose symmetries are the same as if you'd started with some string theory or some higher dimensional field theory and dimensionally reduced it with a boundary. It would give you the same low energy matter content. So this is sort of a lazy model builder shortcut to figuring out what are all of the interesting possible symmetries that can come from the orbifold reduction of a theory. And the reason why you think this might be interesting, the deep secret of why this might be a useful thing to do, is there's a very interesting theorem that if you start with some parent symmetry with some continuous symmetry in it, some parent theory with a continuous symmetry, and you make an orbifold of it by modding out by a discrete global symmetry, you get a daughter theory, which has much less matter in it. But actually, in the large n limit, the correlation functions of the parent and the daughter theory are identical, up to 1/n corrections. And in particular, of course, correlation functions include two-point functions. And so things that look like corrections to the Higgs mass also obey this. And so if you had a symmetry in the parent theory that protected a Higgs, in the daughter theory, it should also protect the Higgs up to 1/n corrections. So this is a way, sort of on the cheap, of if you had a continuous symmetry solution to the hierarchy problem, you could hope to orbifold it and still have a symmetry solution to the hierarchy problem, but without all of the stuff that came along with continuous symmetry. All right, so this starts to feel a lot like a way to generate theories that generalize the twin Higgs. Okay, so I could give you an example of how orbifolds work, but that would put you more to sleep than you already are. So I leave that as an exercise. So the first thing to do is just notice the twin Higgs is, in fact, an orbifold. Okay. So what is the game for the twin Higgs? Well, imagine the parent theory is SU6 cross SU4, and you mod out by a Z2 subgroup, all right, to create an orbifolded daughter theory. I'm going to suppress the U1 because there's lots of ways of making hypercharge work, and I don't want to bore you more than you already are. But if you make this orbifold, the daughter theory that you get is SU3 cross SU2 squared, and each of these copies is related by actually an S2 exchange symmetry, but S2 is just Z2, right? So this is a way to see this is exactly the symmetry group of the twin Higgs. And you get it by imagining that you started with a larger symmetry group and making a Z2 orbifold. Okay. And how all of the matter breaks down works exactly like you might have imagined. If you have some Higgs multiplets in the parent theory under the orbifold, they break into Higgses of the two sectors. If you have quark multiplets in the parent theory, they break into quark multiplets of the two sectors, and so on and so forth. And similarly, if you have a Yukawa interaction in the parent theory, that breaks into Yukawa interactions in the daughter theory. If you have a quartic in the parent theory, it breaks into quartics in the daughter theory. And all of these couplings now have exactly the properties related by the S2 symmetry that you expect for the twin Higgs. So this is just a different way. This is a sort of UV language for talking about where the symmetry of the twin Higgs comes from. You could have said it's a fundamental Z2 symmetry, or you could have said I started in the ultraviolet with a bigger symmetry, and it was reduced by, for example, boundary conditions in an extra dimension, and then the Z2 symmetry I just get as a residual symmetry. Okay. So why is this fun? Well, once you know that that's the rule, you can imagine coming up with sort of grotesque generalizations of the twin mechanism. Okay. So if the recipe is I start out with some larger symmetry group that contains standard model gauge group, and I mod out by a discrete symmetry, I can imagine starting with larger symmetry groups and modding out by larger discrete symmetries. So there's an obvious generalization, which is instead of modding out by Z2, I can imagine modding out by Zn. Then I would get n different copies of the standard model, and I would have an n Higgs mechanism instead of a twin Higgs mechanism. And that's fine. That has actually lots of fun consequences. It has extra Goldstone bosons, and so it has very interesting phenomenology. But it's not the coolest thing you can do. The coolest thing you can do is instead of modding out by an abelian discrete symmetry, mod out by a non-abelian discrete symmetry. So for example, the symmetric or anti-symmetric exchange groups Sn and An are interesting non-abelian discrete symmetries. And so you can just work out for yourself what happens if you construct such an orbifold modding out by a non-abelian discrete symmetry. So to do this, we had to recruit one of Greg Moore's grad students, because non-abelian discrete symmetries are painful. But let me just give you one example of how this can work. So imagine you start with a parent theory that has some large, terrible symmetry group, and you mod out by S3, which is sort of the smallest non-abelian discrete symmetry. Well, the group that you get from doing that, you get two copies of the standard model gauge group, and then you get a copy of like a fat standard model gauge group, right? It's sort of twice the size of the standard model QCD group and the standard model weak gauge group. So basically, you get a twin Higgs sector plus some extra large fat standard model-like sector. And in the matter content, the way the matter content breaks down, in each of these two copies of the standard model gauge group, you get the sort of matter content that you got in the twin Higgs. And then in this fat copy of the standard model gauge group, you get a few extra fields coming along for the ride. Okay. But in the same way, just as in the twin Higgs, where you could imagine the Higgs was a pseudo-Goldstone boson of an accidental SU4, which you could associate with the symmetry of a parent theory, here you can also associate the Higgs as a pseudo-Goldstone boson of this SU12 theory, all right, the parent SU12 theory, even though the low-energy matter content is this funny set of different gauge groups. Okay. And the reason why that is cool is in the twin Higgs, I told you this story, how does the cancellation of quadratic divergences work? Right, we have a quadratic divergence in the standard model, and in twin Higgs, it was canceled by a loop of top partners in the twin sector who had the very special couplings that were required for this cancellation to work. Okay, but there was a color factor of 3 in the standard model loop, there was a color factor of 3 in the twin loop, and that's how the cancellation worked out. Well, in this bizarre non-abelian example, the cancellation mechanism is different. Okay, in this model, what actually happens is you have a quadratic divergence coming from the normal standard model loop, and it's canceled by a linear combination of loops in the other twin gauge group and in the fat gauge group. Okay, now each of these have different numbers of colors, so you would first worry that the number of colors and the loop factor would be off, and this would no longer cancel this. But the way that the orbifold works is that the top Yukawas get rescaled in these two sectors, so that you have different numbers of top partners, but their Yukawa couplings are rescaled in precisely the way that's required for them to cancel the quadratic divergence. Okay, so this is the first time I've ever seen this happen in any sort of model. It's where the cancellation of quadratic divergences happens because there's a conspiracy between the number of fields and the rescaling of their couplings dictated by a symmetry so that they still cancel a quadratic divergence. All right. So this is very different from what happens in supersymmetry of the twin Higgs, and it's an example of some of the very unusual things that can happen if you have a non-abelian orbifold. All right.
The scale of these guys is above now. This is the UV computational coupling scale, right? Or is it
this is actually what gives you so good. So you have to ask where does the orbifold happen?
Yeah,
that's the question.
Orbifold,
So good. So something that I haven't. So this is a one loop calculation that tells you that the one loop quadratic divergences are canceled by some weird set of top partners.
Yeah.
But of course, I told you right. This the correlation functions agree up to 1/n corrections.
Yeah.
So you can ask yourself, well, where is the where are the 1/n corrections? Right. The cancellation should break at some point.
Yeah.
The answer is when you compute the gauge loops. A similar thing happens for the gauge loops. But there's a 1/n piece from this fat standard model group that's not canceled. And so there's a quadratic divergence that comes in at 1/n at one loop.
It's 1/n times lambda squared.
Exactly. So that tells you that you have to have the full UV completion for this theory at 10 or 20 TeV. Okay. So this has to be completed into a full symmetric picture around 10 or 20 TeV. All right. So this tells you, so you bought yourself some really cool phenomenology from the low energy physics. You have lots of different top partners with different couplings, canceling quadratic divergences for the Higgs. But you do have to have a UV completion at low scale. So, you know, between you and me, this is not the theory of the universe, but it's the first time that we've ever seen this happen for symmetry protection of the Higgs, where different particles with different multiplicities from their standard model partner state have different couplings and still cancel the quadratic divergence. Okay. And you can build lots of more theories until you are blue in the something. Okay. So why is this interesting? All right, apart from just being an exercise in you know, orbifolding field theories. Well, it opens the door to a range, I think, of natural theories where you're canceling quadratic divergences to the Higgs mass, but they have a very different structure from the type of theories that we normally think about. Okay, and in all of these cases, they tell you you have new partner particles, but these new partner particles are not charged under the standard model. So all the searches we do with the LHC for partner particles dictated by naturalness are irrelevant. And instead, there's a very different set of signatures. Okay, and then the final point.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Right,
but that's, you know,
it's just
scalars, colored scalars at multi-TV, the LHC doesn't has no reach, right?
No.
The LHC, so for stops, the LHC is, yeah, so good. So if you wanted to use this as sloganeering, you'd say, let's build a 100 TV collider, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it manages, I agree that it manages to push what the color partners are to the multi-TV range.
Right, but that is enough to make them irrelevant for the LHC.
Obviously, yeah.
Okay. So I just want to switch gears now and talk a little bit more about phenomenology. Hopefully, this will help us all to perk up a little bit. I'm sorry if that last bit was abstract. It's just cool because I just want to emphasize the point, if you guys will let me. In like supersymmetry, we say we have a top loop. This gives me a quadratic divergence. It's -6. Really, it's -2 times the number of colors times y top squared quadratic divergence, right? And then we say it's canceled by loops of stops that also have +2 times the number of colors times y top squared times the cutoff squared. But now you can imagine writing down a theory where it is not the number of colors. You know, you don't have to match the number of colors and the Tapiokawas. All that you have to match is the product of the number of colors and the Tapiokawa coupling. And that's what happens in these orbifold theories. You've matched the product of the number of colors and the Yukawa coupling. OK, so that's just cool. All right. So we thought about trying to do them as Susie. The big problem, the biggest problem is that if you wanted to really, so we constructed the field theory orbifolds, which tell you what are the light states that are responsible for making the Higgs light. But you can ask yourself the question, let me imagine I wanted to have this come from string theory or a field theory in extra dimensions. Well, now you have to have an extra dimensions in a manifold that is compatible with an S3 orbifold, which you can't do. You have to have at least 6 dimensions. Okay. So basically, the largest orbifold you can support in 5 dimensions is Z2 or Z2 in a translation, right? You can't get a non-abelian discrete symmetry. So you immediately have to start putting that theory in a larger number of dimensions. And of course, supersymmetry in larger number of dimensions, realistic model building starts to get a little hard. Okay, so there are various challenges to making a complete model for it. But all right, it's an interesting challenge. You know, there are a lot of string theory constructions that have interesting non-abelian orbifolds in them. And so that's probably the simplest way to write down a good theory. Okay. So I just want to take a turn to the phenomenology. If these theories take away all of our signatures at the weak scale at the LHC, are there other signatures? Let's be positive. Are there other signatures we could hope to look for? So one thing you could ask yourself is, just like for global symmetry or supersymmetry, what we really do for the LHC is we write down the minimal set of ingredients required by that theory for the theory to be natural, and then we look for those. So you can repeat the exercise for the twin Higgs. You can ask, what are the minimal ingredients I need for this mechanism to work? And what sort of phenomenology does that give me? Okay, Now you can ask yourself the question again. I started by saying, okay, the twin Higgs has an exact Z2 that relates us to a copy, a twin copy of the standard model, and that would completely fix the spectrum and give you no freedom. But this story that I've just told you about twin-like scenarios coming from orbifolds, that actually gives you a huge amount of freedom to mix and match ingredients to have different fields get projected out by the time you get down to the low energy. And so you can imagine it's a natural generalization of the twin Higgs to just have the ingredients that you require for naturalness and nothing else, and to ask what are the signatures that follow from that. So you can ask yourself what things are required for a minimal twin Higgs model to work. And the answer is it's sort of an interesting set of degrees of freedom. So we know we need some partners of the top quark. So in particular, we have to have a top left and a top right. Then, of course, we know also if we want to have, so that helps us to ensure there's cancellation of quadratic sensitivity coming from the top Yukawa. We also have to have cancellation of weak gauge loops, so we have to gauge SU2. Once we gauge SU2, various other things follow along for the ride. So we need leptons for anomaly cancellation, and we also need something like a bottom right. And then, of course, we need some sort of Higgs-like multiplet to be like the Higgs multiplet of the twin copy so that we can have some radial mode and some spontaneous symmetry breaking. So the minimal set of ingredients for the twin story to work, it's not three generations of the standard model. It's basically just the third generation. All right, and then you also need gauged SU2. You don't have to gauge the U1. And surprisingly, you need to gauge SU3. So I'll explain why you need to gauge SU3 in just a minute. But this is the minimal set of ingredients. And so just like we look for natural SUSY at the LHC or top partners in global symmetry theories, this would be the minimal set of ingredients required for the twin mechanism. So now you can ask the question, what signatures does this give us? All right, so let's go through the list. Looking directly for the partner states, this is what we do, of course, for supersymmetry and global symmetry. This is a bad strategy for the twin theory because these guys don't have standard model quantum numbers. They're not copiously produced. You would have to wait for something like 100 TeV collider to produce them through the Higgs. And we're all going to be pretty much dead by the time that happens. Now, you might think an interesting thing to do is actually look for signatures of this heavy radial mode, right? We know there's a heavy radial mode that corresponds to the sort of spontaneous global symmetry breaking scale. That's at scale F. And so it has some couplings to the standard model. And we could look for those standard model production and decay modes. Now, the issue is this guy only is produced very weakly through the standard model. It mixes by an amount V over F with the standard model. And so that means its production rate is down with respect to something like a two Higgs doublet model. So there are very interesting production and decay modes for the state, but the overall cross-section is relatively suppressed and is something that we can't hope to see. Certainly not, there was no hope of seeing it in run one. There's really no hope in seeing it in the first 100 inverse femtobarn of run two. But if you wait long enough at the LHC, you might be able to pick up some of these modes in searches for exotic Higgses. Okay? High low enough to run, that's right. You could even buy 300 inverse femtobarn, you could start to pick something up. Yeah. So that's very interesting. That's a reason to be excited about searches for exotic Higgs states. But the really fun thing is to actually look for the very light QCD degrees of freedom associated with the story. In particular, the thing that's really exciting to look for is actually the phenomenology that's associated with this twin copy of QCD. Okay? So the reason why you need a twin copy of QCD is very simple. The cancellation mechanism between the standard model and the twin sector is a cancellation coming dominantly from the equality of the top Yukawas. The largest contribution to the running of the top Yukawas comes from QCD. And so if you don't have a copy of twin QCD with a coupling very much like the QCD coupling, then the twin Yukawa coupling is going to be very different from ours, and the cancellation mechanism will fail. So that tells you just immediately, even though, you know, just as in the standard model, gluons only talk to the Higgs at two loops, you would think that this means they don't really matter. Because they're the dominant effect on the top Yukawa coupling, they really have to be there. All right, but now that tells you, you know, confining hidden sector gauge groups are very interesting. They have a lot of rich phenomenology, and maybe they're going to be the key to finding these theories. All right, so in this sort of minimal version of the twin theory, you have some freedom for the value of the twin QCD coupling. It's okay if it's slightly different from our QCD coupling. That doesn't have a devastating effect on the equality of the top Yukawas, but it has to be very similar. And so that means, in particular, it has a confinement scale that's fairly close to the confinement scale of standard model QCD. So you can work out all the details. The confinement scale in the twin sector is typically between about a GeV and 10 GeV. So that's very interesting. It tells us now we have a hidden sector with confined bound states that are in the few GeV range. Okay. Now, the states that are most interesting, so of course we know normally in QCD, if we have our normal copy of the QCD, when it confines, we get We get mesons, we get baryons. In particular, there are mesons that are pions, and those are typically the lightest states. So those are just bound states of quarks. But in this minimal version of the twin theory, right, where we only have twin sector states that are required for the third generation, there's no light fermions. And so the lightest state in twin QCD in these theories is actually a glue ball. Okay. So glue balls are very interesting. You know, we believe glue balls, of course, exist in normal QCD. It's just in normal QCD, they're unstable to decay to lighter resonances. So we really only have indirect evidence for their existence. But in a theory with no light fermions, they should be at the bottom of the spectrum. And we know in general from lattice arguments that the mass of these glue balls is about 7 times the confinement scale of that confining theory. So that's very interesting. If we have this twin sector that confines around a GeV to 10 GeV, that tells us we have these glue ball states that are showing up around a few GeV to about 100 GeV. And glue balls are very special because they have the same quantum numbers as the standard model Higgs. So in particular, you know, the lightest glue ball has the JPC quantum numbers of 0++. Those are the same quantum numbers as the Higgs. And in fact, so you would expect in general that they should mix through higher dimensional operators. In fact, the mixing is required in this theory precisely by the mechanism that makes the twin mechanism work. Okay? So we said, for example, we got cancellations between different loop diagrams when we integrated out the heavy radial mode. That same integrating out also actually gives you interactions that couple the standard model like Higgs to twin glue balls. And so in fact, there is an irreducible connection dictated by the structure of the theory that connects the standard model like Higgs to glue balls in the twin sector. So this both gives us a portal for production. It tells us that every time we produce a Higgs, there's some probability that we'll turn into glue balls in the twin sector. And it also gives us a portal for decay. It tells us if we get a glue ball in the twin sector, there's some probability that will come back to us. And in general, because these are lighter than the standard model Higgs, they'll come back to us through an off-shell Higgs and go to standard model fermions. All right. So there's lots of different rates for this process to happen. You can compute in detail how it all works out. There's sort of two different ways to end up getting producing these glue balls. One is there's sort of the version of Higgs to glue that's just Higgs to twin glue, and then those go to glue balls. So that rate is always there because it comes from a loop of the twin top quark. There's another rate, which is every once in a while our Higgs can go to twin bottom quarks, and those bottom quarks can then annihilate into glue balls. But this rate is sort of adjustable because we have some ability to float the Yukawa coupling for the twin bottoms without changing our naturalness considerations. All right. So there's various rates for this to happen. But the sort of the irreducible rate for this to happen in the standard model gives a branching ratio to twin glue balls of about 0.1%.
Yes. Line, yep. Is the same as ours?
Yep.
What do you get? So it's that line over there.
Good. So now the function, now how often you go to these guys then depends on V relative to F, because that actually adjusts how much our Higgs couples to the twin bottom. So good. So what is this plot actually showing you? These are actually the 1 and 2 sigma curves for a Higgs coupling fit, assuming Higgs coupling deviations from mixing, which is always baked in because it's a pseudo-Goldstone, and then assuming some invisible branching ratio. Okay. All right, so this is sort of the 2 sigma contour.
This is
what Higgs coupling measurements currently tell us. This is the only thing that constrains meaningfully this parameter space is the changes in Higgs couplings. Okay. So now you can ask the question, okay, so if the twin bottom Yukawa coupling is the same as in the standard model, so that's this line here. All right, so where that intersects the 2 sigma curve is right around V over F is around 1/3. Okay. So that tells us that, right. And then you can read over what is the branching ratio into the twin sector, and the branching ratio is about 6%, 8%, okay? So good, so that tells you that if the Yukawa coupling in the bottom sector is the same as in the standard model, you have about an 8% invisible ratio to stuff that could then come back to us if it eventually goes to glue balls, and then there's Higgs coupling deviations that come from order V over F mixing that's about 1/3. The Higgs coupling deviations directly are about 1/9. Okay, all right, so if that's the case, then you have about 8% of standard model Higgs decays go into these glue ball states. But if you have smaller bottom Yukawa couplings, then the only thing that you know that you have is production of glue balls through this portal into twin glue. All right. So what is the awesome, fantastic thing about this is, so that's every once in a while you produce one of these twin glue balls. But of course, if you have a twin glue ball, now every once in a while it comes back to us by decaying through an off-shell Higgs. And if you just work out the lifetime, the C tau for this, putting in sort of reasonable numbers for the values of these scales, you get that the C tau is about the length scale of one of the LHC detectors, which, you know, God didn't tell you this had to be the case, but it turns out that the length scale for the decay of these glue balls is right on the macroscopic length scale that we happen to build detectors. The smallest smallest invisible branching you have to have is 0.1%. Okay, so that's the smallest rate that is possible in this theory. It's 0.1% up to 10%. That's sort of the range.
Yeah.
And then the C tau is somewhere on the LHC length scale. Of course, you notice it's a strong function of the glue ball mass and of F. But even if you vary these, right, that just tells you you scan between something that's on the order of a kilometer. Okay, kilometers out of reach for us. But you could be on the tail of that distribution. Or something that's actually on the order of, for example, microns, which is still something that's a displacement that we can actually pick up. Well, something, you know, certainly we can pick up something on the order of centimeter at the LHC. And so that's actually still, even if it's not 10 meters, that's still something we can pick up in a displaced decay. Okay, so that's very interesting because we have detectors that are perfectly designed to actually pick up displaced decays of these lengths. And so this is just some, you know, the thing that I just want to emphasize is this is a beautiful possible signature. A theory is where we've gotten rid of colored top partners, but now we have interesting glue ball states that are required to exist in the twin sector. They can come back to us with an interesting lifetime, and it turns out that the C tau is about the length scale of the LHC. So this takes us from looking for production of colored states as a sign of naturalness to looking for displaced decays as a sign of naturalness, and I think it accomplishes this idea of thinking about naturalness pushing us in different directions. Okay, so existing searches, I just want to say very briefly, we're not quite in the right ballpark just yet. So actually, things are getting close in some regimes. So Atlas and CMF both have interesting searches. Atlas searches actually get into the ballpark of 10% branching ratios of the Higgs. They're sensitive to just certain decay lengths. So the more interesting decay lengths, so this is actually some regions of the parameter space can currently be constrained by Atlas, but there's a lot of other regions of parameter space we hope to get into in run two. CMS right now is totally out of the game because they have a very badly designed search for this. But this is something where both collaborations, we could hope to make a lot of progress in run two.
Are these rate-limited searches?
Good. Let's see.
I can't think of many things that would take this.
Yeah, so the background's so good. So what is the issue? Well, okay, so the issue is they've been designed as, in some sense, rate-limited, right? So the reason why CMS is not even in the game is they have a large H2 requirement for the displaced decays. And so that means that if something is coming from the decay of a Higgs, it just never triggers. Okay. So that just puts, the thing you would hope CMS could do is lower their HT threshold so that they would pick up these events, although then they would start to have non-trivial backgrounds, and then it's an interesting question of what is the sensitivity. Okay. Atlas, yeah, I mean, primarily the constraint on Atlas that gives them good discrimination and basically zero background is they trigger on one displaced decay, but they require two, right? All right, so there's various things you could do to hope to improve sensitivity at run two. The most interesting thing I think you could do, which is not being done, is right now we don't have any productive combination of displaced decay triggers and Higgs-associated production triggers. And since you know these events are coming from a displaced decays of the Higgs, you could try to make more use of Higgs-associated production. So I think this is the main opportunity as far as lessons for encouraging the collaborations. Of course, the big lesson for CMS is don't have such a high HT requirement, but the big lesson for Atlas is to ask if there's a productive way to combine their current displaced decay and associated production triggers. Okay. All right, I bored you all for a long time. I will just tell you a very quick story at the end that is, Robert could actually tell you this story.
Yeah.
I'll skip it because I'll bet you Robert did a better job than I'm going to do. All right, the last thing is every time we solve the hierarchy problem, we also like to have a dark matter candidate. There is a super abundance of dark matter candidates in these theories. It's not surprising. You can make lots of them work. Andrea and I had a bad paper about this. Robert had a wonderful paper about this. There are lots of, so we did the easiest thing. Okay, so what is the easiest thing is to just come up with a normal thermal dark matter candidate, which is like the twin tau. So we worked out, and it is a beautiful story because the Wimp miracle is imperfect, right? The mass scale, the Wimp miracle, it's imperfect in the sense that the mass scale that is actually selected by the Wimp miracle is not 100 GeV, it's like a TeV, right? And so that's a little imperfect. And here we have a theory that has similar couplings, but the intrinsic scale of the weak interactions is F instead of V, right? So this is a theory where the Wimp miracle actually wants to work, not in our sector, but in the twin sector, okay? So there's a beautiful way to make that work with a dark matter candidate. But that's just using one of the stabilization symmetries. There are lots of other stabilization symmetries. The most beautiful stabilization symmetry is something like twin baryon number, and then that really inspires you to think about asymmetric dark matter candidates. So the reason why I say Robert wrote a wonderful paper, for lots of reasons, one is that they took seriously the possibility of asymmetric dark matter candidates. All right, so you can ask Robert about that later. The only thing, the punchline that's just worth emphasizing, you can get good thermal dark matter candidates this way. And what's really nice about them is that they live really right at the threshold of current sensitivity. So if this is how the universe works, we should know actually in direct detection very soon. All right. So I know I've tried to cover a lot of ground in this talk. This has sort of been a survey of what I've been excited about in neutral naturalness over the last 2 years. If you got nothing out of this talk, I hope you're at least convinced that we understand now the sense in which we can take naturalness out of just continuous symmetries, and we can actually write down theories for the weak scale that make productive use of discrete symmetries. And when we do that, right, that puts the degrees of freedom responsible for naturalness in hidden sectors. Those hidden sectors are connected to us via the Higgs portal, and that just changes radically how we think of the signatures of these theories. It opens the door to a lot of different phenomenology. I think something that is particularly resonant here at Perimeter, where you guys have made a lot of great progress on thinking about new ways to look for different degrees of freedom that are sequestered from the standard model, is this provides a sort of, if you wanted some motivation for why you should expect rich hidden sectors that are connected to us through the Higgs portal, this is a beautiful sort of naturalness motivated way to motivate these scales and motivate these interactions. So I've sort of tried to give you a lot of examples of how these things can work. But we're very much in the exploratory phase, right? There's a lot of things. We haven't had 30 years to study these theories. I think there's a lot of rich things to do here. And it has a lot of consequences for our experimental search program. So hopefully it's something we can continue to pursue fruitfully. But in the meantime, thank you very much for your patience today. It was great to talk to you. Folded Susie?
Eh?
What else do you want to hear about? Tell me about folded.
So folded Susie, the cancellation is not as good, right? It only works at one loop.
The cancellation only works at one loop, right? So folded Susie tells you you have to have a supersymmetric extra dimension at 10 TeV. There are actually other problems. I can tell you these. So who knows about folded supersymmetry here? Can I give the brief? Okay, a couple of people. Let me give the brief. Well, who needs to go and relax? Anyone who wants to leave now can leave, and then I won't hold it against you.
When do you have to?
3. So I got 50 minutes. So we should take 20 minutes to gossip at the end.
But, yes.
Okay. All right. So what is folded supersymmetry? So you can imagine this story is like the twin Higgs is like the discrete symmetry version of a global symmetry solution to the hierarchy problem. So you can ask, what is the discrete symmetry version of a supersymmetry solution to the hierarchy problem? That is to say, in supersymmetry, we have loops of scalars, stops, that cancel quadratic divergences coming from top loops. But now you could say, can I cook up some weird model where these guys don't have QCD quantum numbers? Right? There's nothing about the stop loop that tells you that it had to have a QCD quantum number. Its contraction with the Higgs, of course, traces over the QCD quantum numbers. So this cancellation would work if this guy were charged not under QCD, but under some other SU3. Okay, so that would be like a supersymmetry theory where you had scalar top partners, but the scalar top partners didn't have QCD quantum numbers. So this is a harder game to play. All right, it's a harder game to play because supersymmetry commutes with the standard model gauge group. So making somehow a supersymmetric partner particle that has different quantum numbers requires that you do great violence to supersymmetry. Anytime you want to do great violence to supersymmetry, it's best to do it in a dark alley or in extra dimensions. So the way you do it in extra dimensions is you say, let me imagine a flat fifth dimension. And let me imagine that I have two four-dimensional boundaries on my space. So what I want to do is imagine constructing a space that is S1 mod Z2. And then I also want to actually break supersymmetry with boundary conditions. So morally speaking, what I'm actually doing is my manifold is S1 mod Z2 cross Z2. So what that is to say, so anytime I have a flat extra dimension, the bulk preserves n equals 2 supersymmetry, the boundaries each preserve an n equals 1 supersymmetry, but they can be different n equal 1s. So this is 1 equals 1, this is n prime is equal to 1. And if these are not the same generators with respect to the bulk SU2, the bulk n equals 2 supersymmetry, then supersymmetry is completely broken at the level of the zero modes. Okay, so now to make a theory where we have top partners that are not charged under QCD, we imagine, we can imagine, well, there are various places we could put our Higgs multiplets. Let me put them on the brain. And then let me put Q, U, D, L, and E all in the bulk. And let me also make two copies of them. And let me imagine that my gauge symmetry is SU3A cross SU3B. I'm just going to have one SU2 cross U1. And then there's a Z2 that exchanges the A and the B QCD copies. Okay? So this is different from the twin Higgs, right? The twin Higgs would say, I double the entire standard model gauge group. Here, all I'm doing is doubling QCD. The reason for that is that the way that scalar top partners couple through the Higgs is through a marginal interaction. The marginal interaction contracts over electroweak interactions. So we can't play the game where we double SU2 and still have everything work. We have to have the same SU2. Okay. So we're just doubling the QCD. We have an exchange symmetry. So that means all of these guys have Yukawa couplings to the Higgses. All of these guys have Yukawa coupling to the Higgses. The Z2 symmetry guarantees that they're the same. And then you choose the boundary conditions such that when you dimensionally reduce this theory, you get only the fermions, the light fermions out of these guys, and you get light scalars out of these. Okay? And then you've arranged it in such a way that the scalars of these multiplets have the same Yukawa couplings as the scalars of these multiplets, but these guys are heavy and these guys are light. So these guys act as the top partners of standard model fermions, and it's the scalar components of these multiplets that are like the stops, but they're not charged under our SU3, they're charged under someone else's SU3. So, all right. So let me tell you why this is a bad theory. Okay.
So far I don't see it yet.
So the one reason why it's a bad theory. Okay. So yeah, there's nothing terribly wrong. I mean, apart from taste. All right.
Okay.
Let's set it. We suspended taste for the purposes of this talk.
Yeah.
So what is the main issue you have? Well, the main issue is the following. You have volume suppression of your Yukawa coupling. Anytime you have some number of bulk fields coupling with a Yukawa, the Yukawas are forbidden by n equals 2 in the bulk. You have to write them down in the brain, so you get volume suppression. So the volume suppression, goes like 1 on, so okay, this is a 5D theory. It has a cutoff. Let me call that cutoff m star. So the volume suppression is the order 1 over the radius. Okay, good. So this has to at most be a few, right? This can only be a factor of a few larger than the inverse radius in order for the top Yukawa coupling not to get squished. Now, what is the problem that makes your life a pain? You have to impose the Z2 exchange symmetry. The Z2 exchange symmetry you can impose in the bulk, and you can impose on one of the brains, but it cannot be simultaneously imposed on both brains. So in particular, it is not valid on one of the two brains. And now you can have large kinetic terms, brain kinetic terms that don't respect the Z2.
Yeah.
Exactly. So things you don't want to know. You can impose a different Z2 symmetry that protects the Yukawas, all right? But what actually gets you is the non-Z2 symmetric kinetic terms on this side actually feed into the soft spectrum. So if we break supersymmetry by boundary conditions, normally we have a nice predictive spectrum.
Yeah.
But that predictive spectrum actually gets spoiled by the brain localized kinetic terms here.
Yeah. Okay.
And you can't make them go away because you need the Yukawa.
Okay. So in the case of the orbifold twin, don't you have a similar problem?
No. Okay, so in the orbifold twin, what you want to do is you want to say,
it's the right brain operator.
Here I had to break supersymmetry with the boundary conditions to swap these scalars with these scalars. Okay, so I had to use Susie breaking with boundary conditions.
Yeah.
For the orbifold twin Higgs, Susie can be broken in a normal 4D way that is not scary.
I see.
Okay, and I can have enough symmetries on both of these brains that the Yukawa couplings are protected. Okay, so it's what kills you. What kills you here is you had to break supersymmetry with the boundary conditions, and that's what comes back to make you hate life. Okay, so that's the primary problem with this theory. There are other problems I don't want to inflict upon you. If you actually work out the best possible theory that breaks electric symmetry, it's tuned at about the 5% level, so it's not actually much better than the MSSM.
Well, now you're starting to question.
Anyway. Folded, I mean, the thing that is most interesting about Folded is that the glue ball phenomenology is even more robust. So I told you this story with the twin, that the glue balls were the lightest states, but that's only true if you got rid of the light fermions in the twin sector, right? Here, the glue balls are always the lightest states, because in the twin sector, there are no light fermions because of the orbifold. There's only scalars at a few hundred GeV, and so that tells you the glue balls are forced upon you, and that means that that is an invariant signature of that theory. But I think in a realistic theory, you'd actually see the KK modes first. Yeah. So, all right. Anyway. Yeah, I've inflicted enough pain on all of you today, so thank you very much.
Thank you.